Well, good morning. Appreciated the service so far. Thank you for those songs, Jim. One of them we actually want to maybe make our song of the month. It was, forget the title now, but number 24, I think it was, or 28. Ends with Lays. Anyway. We are in challenging times, I guess. It's easy to become fearful, I think. But I guess the comforting thing is we have been, as humans, we've been through an incredible amount of stuff, and God has preserved us for a reason. And so I don't think, and especially the church, the Christians in the church, He has not forgotten about us. Look at what the Christians in Romania faced, which is close there to Ukraine, where they were directly targeted, and how God preserved them, and now there's an incredible testimony there of that, and just in getting to meet with some of those people that went through that, and going through communism and all that, what God brought them through, and He will continue to do that. That's not really what we're going to be looking at this morning. I'm going to start off with a story that I came across to kind of maybe help illustrate my point. So a couple of years ago, eBay had a large chunk of their stock purchased by a hedge fund. The name of the hedge fund was Elliott Management. And this management of this hedge fund sent a letter to eBay's board of directors, basically saying that eBay needs to change some things, suggesting that they replace their CEO. And needless to say, this kind of put the CEO and kind of the whole board of directors on edge. And around the same time, a website named ecommercebytes.com, it was owned and run by Dan and Ina Steiner, and I'm assuming they're not related to the Steiners that we know, that's based in Boston. Anyway, this couple had developed this site as kind of a resource for sellers on different platforms, e-commerce platforms, but wrote a lot of articles about eBay and Amazon and different seller platforms. Anyway, they wrote a couple articles that were critical of eBay, and especially one that kind of pointed out how much the CEO was making in relation to the rest of the eBay's employees. Anyway, this kind of got under the CEO's skin. It just really rubbed him wrong. And it's a small site. It's not like it was national news or anything. But it just got under their skin. And the name of the CEO, eBay CEO, was Devin Wenig. And he told his communications director in a text, he said, take them down. He just gave him instructions to take them down. So the communications director talked to the head of the security department of eBay, who happened to be a former FBI employee. So this guy went all in. He's like, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to take them down. Anyway, this Jim Bao is his name, the head of eBay security. He put a team together that came up with this plan to take down this couple and their site. And they started by making a number of fake social media accounts. They did something called doxing, which is where you publish somebody's address. So if somebody doesn't like you, they know where you live, and you know, it's pretty intimidating. Then they started a series of deliveries to their house. It started with a bloody pig mask, a box of live cockroaches, a box of spiders, a funeral wreath, pizza deliveries at 4:30 in the morning. Some of the creepier ones, a book titled Surviving the Death of Your Spouse, and a number of other pretty intimidating things. I mean, there was yeah, some other stuff that I won't go into. If you want to read the story, let me know. I'll get you the link. But they also published some stuff on Craigslist. One of them was a Everything Must Go sale with instructions to just go into the house if you don't see anyone outside. Personal posts, yeah, looking for singles, week-long block party. Anyway, next thing they did was actually send people to Boston from the team. And I think Jim actually went himself. They registered for a software conference in Boston as kind of a cover, but then sent people out to just watch the house, and if this couple would leave, they'd follow them around and make sure that they knew it. Well, they were trying to get license plates. The couple, of course, was just completely freaked out. I mean, obviously, I don't think there's no indications anyway that they were Christians, so they were just completely freaked out for their safety. And the police didn't. The police were trying to do something, but they didn't really have anything to go on. Anyway, the last part of the scheme that was supposed to happen was Jim, the director of eBay security, was going to contact them and say, "Hey, we see that you're being harassed online. Can we help?" And they were going to become the white knights that kind of came in and stopped the whole thing in the hopes that this would kind of gain some favor with eBay in exchange for them not publishing negative stuff anymore. Well, fortunately, it didn't get to that point. David Steiner actually was able to get a license plate, and one of the ladies on the team registered the rental car in her name, which was kind of a dumb move. Well, she used her credit card, which was linked back to her name. And because it was interstate, the FBI got involved and pretty quickly figured it out, what was going on. Well, Jim lied about it as soon as law enforcement talked to him, but they still uncovered the whole thing, which put him into more trouble. Anyway, I think like 7 people were charged and are going to do prison time for it. Likewise, we're going to look at a story in Exodus in which a man should have been a good leader and wasn't. He had a bad idea, and he made some bad choices that led to a whole bunch of other people doing some pretty bad things. And we're actually going to read, and I'm talking about what happens after God gives the Ten Commandments. We're actually going to read the account from Deuteronomy because there's more detail, or at least part of it. So if you want to turn to Deuteronomy 9, we're going to read 6 through 12, verses 6 through 12. So Deuteronomy 9, verses 6. It says, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people." And just for some context, this is actually Moses speaking to the children of Israel. It was a little bit hard for me to figure out who was talking here. Was this God talking? But this is actually Moses talking to the children of Israel. Verse 7, "Remember and do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day you came out of the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. Even at Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath, and the Lord was so angry with you that he was ready to destroy you. When I went up the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant that the Lord made with you, I remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. And the Lord gave me the 2 tablets of stone written with the finger of God. On them were all the words that the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. And at the end of 40 days and 40 nights, the Lord gave me the 2 tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, 'Arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you have brought from Egypt have acted corruptly. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them, and they have made themselves a metal image.'" From there, let's jump back to Exodus, the actual account there's a little bit more details in Exodus. So Exodus 32. And last time we looked at the Ten Commandments and what was God's plan or motive, I guess, in giving those. Well, that was all the way back in, I think it's, what is it, chapter 24? No, it's before that. So there's a whole bunch of stuff between the giving of the Ten Commandments and the covenant that God made with the children of Israel and 32, and that's the part where God is giving more commands, laws, instructions for the tabernacle to Moses. And I'm not going to really dig into that, but there's a lot of stuff that God is giving to Moses between there. Anyway, so if we go to 32, verse 1, I'm going to read down to verse 10. It says, "When the people saw that Moses delayed to come up from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, 'Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' So Aaron said to them, 'Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.' When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord.' And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt."' And the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you.'" Wow. Okay, so there's a lot of stuff in there. But just the first thing I actually noticed here was back in the account in Deuteronomy. I guess I'd never noticed this before. The number 40 jumped out at me, that Moses was on the mountain with God for 40 days and 40 nights. And if you think about the number 40, it's all over in Scripture. It's actually 146 times if you look at it according to what I read. And just a couple examples here: rain fell for 40 days and 40 nights during the flood. Noah waited for 40 days after the tops of the mountains were seen after the flood before he sends out the raven. Spies were sent by Moses to explore the land of Canaan for 40 days. The Israelites had to wander in the wilderness outside of Canaan for 40 years. Goliath challenged the Israelites twice a day for 40 days before David defeated him. Moses' life is separated into three 40-year segments, and we looked at that earlier. 40 years growing up in Egypt, and then 40 years kind of wandering around in the wilderness and the desert leading sheep, and then 40 years actually leading the children of Israel out of Egypt into Canaan. And then the account here, the 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai. And then Jonah warns Nineveh for 40 days more, or Nineveh will be destroyed. He gives them that warning. And then jumping forward to Jesus, and this is just a small sampling of them. There's a lot more, obviously. But Jesus fasts for 40 days and 40 nights before he is tempted by Satan in the Judean wilderness. 40 days was the period from the resurrection of Jesus until his ascension to heaven. I would have forgotten about that one. And according to what we understand of who wrote the Bible, it was 40 different authors. I didn't know that one either. That was kind of interesting. So is there some, I don't know, divine inspiration we can get from the number 40? Well, I don't know. I haven't found it yet, I guess. It's just interesting to me, and it's what popped out, so I'm sharing it with you. Maybe there's some significance there that I just haven't gained. God does everything for a reason. I just find it interesting that that God has that pattern. It does seem like there's kind of a connection with the number 40 and maybe a time of testing, a period of trial. And one thing for sure, this account here is definitely connected to Jesus' temptation. The difference is the Israelites were tempted, or tested, I guess, for 40 days. What are they going to do after God makes a covenant with them? Will they hold up their end of the bargain? And they're given 40 days as a testing period, and they fail that very miserably. Jesus was given the same testing period, and he comes through with flying colors. So I think there's a reason Jesus was fasted for 40 days in the wilderness and then was tempted. It was to show that he was the perfect man, I guess, replacement for Moses that never sinned. And then, I guess, moving forward, and there is a lot of different other things we could look at here, but I was actually expecting to spend most of my time looking at how this event kind of explains to us the character of people, of humans. But I think we've done enough of that, maybe. We've already seen how miserably the Israelites have failed in other tests. You know, they're given a couple days without water, and they already start complaining and not trusting that God is going to take care of them. Just obviously we know the character of mankind. But the thing that really jumped out to me as I started into this was the character of Aaron, and I guess maybe the lack of good character in Aaron. And I guess personally I've always thought, well, God used Aaron. He must have thought highly enough of him to continue to use him. I mean, later he's kind of put as the head of the priests. But wow, if you start digging into what actually happened here, I'm kind of amazed by that. I guess it's only the mercy of God, and we'll see later that God wanted to actually destroy him right there, and it was only the prayers of Moses that saved him. Otherwise, God would have destroyed him, it says. Anyway, if we jump back to verse 1 and 2, I'm just going to go down and look at the events that happen here. So back to Exodus 32. I'll just read verse 1 and 2 again. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Does the King James say, "As for this fellow"? I should have looked that up. Or as for this Moses, okay. I think maybe I was reading a commentary where it said the translation could be, "As for this fellow," like kind of a coarse term for him, we don't know what's happened to him. Like, he's not important, whatever, he went and did his thing. It's kind of how the translation, if you look at the Hebrew, would read. So, like, they had seen how God had worked through Moses, and they're just like, whatever, you know, he's not here to help us, so moving on. But the thing that I thought was really interesting here, I'll just read verse 2. "So Aaron said to them, 'Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me.'" And I never really thought through, what was his thought process in doing that? So obviously Aaron had an idea that this was not a good idea. I mean, he doesn't just immediately say, "Yeah, okay, sure, go do it." So why would he say, "Bring me your gold earrings from your wives and your sons and your daughters"? Well, okay, so what's the most valuable thing the people would have had in terms of monetarily? Maybe being out in a wilderness and nobody else around to trade with. Gold isn't going to be that valuable at the time, but as far as, you know, going for the future, gold is going to be the most valuable thing they have. So he tells them, "Well, bring me all your gold." And I think, and this, I borrowed this from some commentaries, so this isn't an original thought with me, but I think it makes sense. I think Aaron was stalling here and trying to give them something that they wouldn't want to do and kind of put the ball back in their court, hoping that they would say, well, we don't really want to give up our gold. I mean, we're not that into making idols here or another god. In the hopes that he doesn't just have to say no to them. But they just do it. They just go ahead and do it. And so instead of just making the choice right there and saying, this is not a good idea and here's why. You made a covenant to God. This is sinning against the God that just brought you out of Egypt. Absolutely not. And I have a feeling that's what Moses would have done if they would have tried this on him. He gives them a choice, and well, they go ahead and want to do it. So they're willing to sacrifice that, and you know, the people don't even flinch. They just bring Aaron all the gold. And now at this point, Aaron still could have said, you know what, this is not according to the plan of God. We should not be doing this. But he had kind of given them a choice, and they made it, so he had already given them an option. And so going back at that point would have been even more difficult, so he goes ahead with it. But because, you know, because he had humored them to start with, he now feels like he needs to follow through, I think. So he makes them this golden calf. Now the text, I think most translations would say calf, but there's a number of scholars that actually think that would be better translated as a bull, not necessarily a calf. So for as far as like an image, you know, a young bull, but in the prime, I guess. Not necessarily a little, you know, cute little calf. If you look at the word, I guess. Anyway, he makes this carving, and you know, if you spent time carving something and then suddenly thousands of people liked it enough to wanted to turn it into a god, you'd be a little bit flattered, I think. And I think there's a human aspect that came into this. I get the feeling that Aaron was a people pleaser. And all of us have some aspect of that in us, I think. We want other people to like us and like what we do, and we want to be respected. Maybe some of us, that's more of a struggle than others. But I think to some degree, we all have that. And I think that Aaron had the same feeling. The people loved what he did. And even though he knew it wasn't a good idea, he was flattered by it. And they want to make this thing into God, and they like it so much. So what does he do? Well, he makes an altar. Why would you make an altar to something that you just carved? Well, I think, again, he was probably humoring the people because they wanted this thing to be a god. And so the people are going through with that, and he's kind of facilitating that. But what he says next just really hit me pretty hard. If you look at verse 5, it says, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. And the first thing I looked at is that a capital L or is that a lowercase L? Because is he saying, this is the Lord now that you wanted? Or is he saying, we're going to make a feast to the Lord? Well, at least in the ESV, it's all caps Lord. So he's talking about the one true God. And yet he leaves the calf up there behind that altar. So he's trying to redirect this idea of wanting to worship this God back to the one true God, but he's not removing that idol. He's leaving that up there as an option. So he's adding the two, trying to mix the two together. And in some ways, I think that's worse, right? It's when you try to mix worship of the true God with worship of idols, of self, whatever, I think God hates that even more than just walking away from God and worshiping something else. And I think that's part of why God was just so incredibly angry with this. Aaron was not making a choice and saying, okay, if you're going to do this, let's do it all the way and let's get rid of God altogether. He's trying to still bring God back into it and appease probably what he knew God was not happy with what the people wanted. And, you know, he probably didn't anticipate what was going to happen next, but the people just go completely crazy. I mean, they ate this up, and it says the next he made this proclamation. Doesn't say anything about worshiping, you know, this calf, but they're going to do a feast to the Lord. Well, it says that the people rose up early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, obviously to this new God that they'd set up, not to the one true God. And from there on, we don't hear anything more from Aaron. Like, he doesn't try to step in and stop what goes on next. At least there's no indication of that. And it turns into some pretty wicked stuff. I mean, it doesn't give us details here, but it says that they sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play, and the word there is not prisoner's base. It's a term that's used for some pretty wicked stuff. And I won't go into details on that, but this wasn't just a fun time or a feast time with family. It turned into, stuff that God would have been or was horrified by, and Moses was too. So when Moses comes back down, this is going on. Going back to Aaron, what's the first thing that Aaron does? If we read, where is it here? Forgot to write it in my notes here. Verse 21, Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such a great sin upon them?" And that's interesting how he words that. So he's asking, what did the people do to you that you brought this sin upon them? So Moses is pointing back to Aaron and saying, you brought this on them. And what's Aaron's response? "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot." So I think the modern equivalent of that would be, just take a chill pill, we'll talk this through, it's fine. He didn't want to make a big deal out of this. And then the next thing, verse 22, the end there, "You know the people, that they are set on evil." Well, that was true. I mean, they were the ones that came up with this idea. But the buck still stopped with him, right? He had the decision to make. And what does he do when he's confronted with the decision that he made? He points it back on the people. Well, you know they're set on evil. And then he goes through and says what the people told him to do. But you know the ending there is not exactly accurate. "So I said to them, 'Let any who have gold take it off.' So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came a calf." Well, it's one way to put it, I guess. And like I already said, God was very angry with Aaron. If you look at Deuteronomy 9, verse 20, which I guess I wouldn't have read, but it says, "And the Lord was so angry with Aaron that he was ready to destroy him, and I prayed for Aaron also at the same time." This is in the context of Moses saying that he spent another 40 days and nights. It says that he was laid prostrate before God, just praying for the people. And then verse 20 there says that he was also praying for Aaron, that God would spare him. So, I mean, there's so many things we could look at here, but I think the thing that jumped out to me was contrast how Moses led earlier, and the resoluteness of, this is what we're doing, this is what God told me to do, this is where we're going, versus what Aaron tries to do. In keeping the people happy, but also wanting to kind of, please God, and not taking a stand on either one. What did that end up leading to? And just the wickedness that came out of that. And I had to think, we spent, when we were studying the life, earlier part of the life of Moses, all the stuff that God took him through, just incredible hard things, and then bringing him back into a place of being, I guess, ready to lead the people of Israel. I think all that stuff brought him to a place where he didn't care anymore what people thought. He was out to do what God wanted him to do because God had taken him through all that hard stuff. And so I think maybe the challenge to us or the encouragement is those hard things are there for a reason that God takes us through. They may be a preparation for something that he's preparing you for, something big, maybe even just something small and leading your family. But just looking more specifically at this account, what are some of the lessons I guess we can take away from it? Well, I think